The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're starting with an article from the Wellness section. What is mild cognitive impairment? So, someone you love has been diagnosed. Here's what MCI is and how to slow its progress. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Thinking about what's going on in our brains is not only incredibly meta, but also weirdly uncomfortable. That's because most of our cognitive functions happen without our noticing at all. Knowing your keys are on the wall hook, remembering an appointment, understanding what year it is, these thoughts fire off in our brains without a hitch. That is, until something in our body disrupts them. One such disruptor is mild cognitive impairment, often shortened to MCI. This diagnosis is characterized by subtle yet noticeable changes in memory and cognitive ability, says Sarah McKay, PhD, a neuroscientist and author of The Women's Brain Book. It's more of a decline than you would expect for someone's age. MCI sounds scary, but it doesn't signal the end. Below, we answer your questions about the diagnosis and offer simple ways to keep your brain sharp. What symptoms should I look out for? Memory loss is the primary sign, but MCI can also include difficulty with complex thinking, decision-making, or attention, says Patricia Boyle, PhD, a neuropsychologist who works with the Rush Alzheimer's Disease Center in Chicago and serves on the McKnight Brain Research Foundation's Board of Trustees. It's struggling to remember things, activities, events. It creeps into someone's everyday life in a way that's slightly disruptive. These symptoms might look like this: forgetting a recent conversation or starting to lose things like keys, glasses, or phone, and not just once, McKay says. Other examples: struggling to follow the plot of Emily in Paris or getting too distracted to finish a simple task like laundry. So if I lose my keys every day, do I have MCI? Not likely. All people have moments where our cognitive function is not optimal for a variety of reasons, Boyle says. Sometimes we have brain fog from something like long COVID, menopause, or stress due to an upcoming presentation, or we're just running on 4 hours of sleep. But for most people, these tendencies bounce around. We don't feel that way all the time. MCI is characterized by constant cognitive issues or a steady decline in brain function. In order for tendencies like losing your keys to constitute MCI, they'd have to be accompanied by other similar symptoms that happen on a regular basis. Uh-oh, could my constant brain fog be MCI? It depends on the source. Some people develop MCI as a result of medication, McKay says. This underlying cause is reversible if you quit the meds, but other reversible causes might not be so obvious. Depression or major stress could cause impairment to show up in testing, too, Boyle says. MCI might also develop as a result of head injury. We're starting to see that emerging from lots of the professional collision sports like rugby and football, McKay says. Overall, though, if you can't determine any underlying cause of your brain fog, it's time to see a doctor. Can MCI lead to dementia or Alzheimer's? The unfortunate truth? Yes. MCI is thought of as a preclinical phase of dementia, says Boyle. That means it often leads to one of those diagnoses, particularly if doctors don't find another underlying cause. Individuals who have MCI are almost 7 times more likely to develop Alzheimer's, dementia, or other forms of dementia than those who don't, Boyle says. But here's how you can tell it's just MCI, not anything more major, yet. Someone with MCI might repeatedly lose everyday things, McKay says. Someone with dementia might find their keys but not know what they're for. Remember, MCI's changes will be more subtle. With dementia or Alzheimer's, the changes are more drastic and much more aggressive. They may not actually be able to take care of themselves and go about their daily life, McKay says. The good news is that it is possible to slow MCI's progression. Focusing on a healthy lifestyle, more on that below, will keep your brain working to the best of its ability. You might be tempted to jump on the medication bandwagon immediately, but research is still determining how helpful drugs for dementia and Alzheimer's actually are for MCI. Talk to your doctor about your options and keep an eye out for continued developments. These warning signs sound a little familiar. How do I get tested? Hopefully, you're staying on top of your regular healthcare appointments. Next time you see your general practitioner, mention that you're starting to notice some memory and cognition issues. They'll refer you to a specialist like a neurologist. There, you'll take a screening test like the Mini Mental State Examination or Montreal Cognitive Assessment, which asks simple questions such as, what time is it? What year? What season? What day of the week? Where are you? What city? What country? What building? What floor? What room? And so on. You might also be asked to remember words or count backward by 7. If you've referred to another doctor after your screening, they'll do a full medical history plus more in-depth cognitive testing, blood work, and brain scans. McKay says the doctor in charge of the diagnosis will be putting together different pieces in a puzzle before they make their diagnosis. Is MCI preventable? No, but you can lower your risk of developing it. It's never too early or too late to implement lifestyle changes that'll boost brain health and plasticity, says Wendy Suzuki, PhD, a neuroscientist and professor of neural science and psychology at New York University and author of Healthy Brain, Happy Life. A recent study found that about 45% of dementia cases are preventable if modifiable risk factors like hearing loss, high LDL cholesterol, and lack of higher education are addressed, McKay says. Suzuki recently co-instructed a masterclass series, Brain Health, that covered ways to do so. The people living longer with good cognition are active. They're controlling stress and they're not eating high sugar, ultra-processed foods, she says. In the masterclass, aerobic exercise, getting good sleep, and plant-based eating are recommended. Suzuki also outlines 4 elements that make memory stick: repetition, novelty, association, and emotional resonance. Leaning into those things can make memory stronger. There's one more unexpected but essential key to brain protection: a sense of purpose. A very robust predictor of health outcomes is the sense that your life is meaningful, Boyle says. People who have high purpose in life are more than twice less likely to develop MCI or other dementia than those that have lower purpose. The mortality rate is lower when you have higher purpose too. But knowing what you want out of life isn't so simple. You can start small. Learn a new language. Read a new book series. Get engaged in volunteering. The goal is to have goals. Get connected and activate your emotions. In doing so, you'll be more optimistic and less lonely. two more qualities that Boyle links to better health. We're moving over into food with some recipes. Three decadent chocolate treats to make this fall. Delicious recipes from New York's favorite chocolatier, Maribel Lieberman. And this article is by Maribel Lieberman. If you have a sweet tooth, keep reading. New Yorkers adore master chocolatier Maribel Lieberman's famous Maribel chocolate shops and cacao bars. Now you can recreate some of her delights with recipes from the new cookbook Maribel Entertains. Think dark chocolate truffles, chocolate-covered toffee bites, or a flourless orange almond cake with chocolate topping. All perfect recipes to enjoy as temperatures cool outside. Dark chocolate truffles. The secret to creating truffles, stars of the chocolate universe, is choosing top quality cocoa powder and chocolate. Even if I've already served a cake or cookies at the end of a meal, I like to pass around a small plate of confections with coffee and after-dinner drinks. Dark chocolate truffles. Here's a perfect truffle recipe from master chocolatier Maribel Lieberman. So it makes 40 truffles. The ingredients are 6 1/3 ounce of 64% dark chocolate roughly chopped. 4 1/3 ounce, 38% milk chocolate, roughly chopped. 2/3 cup of heavy cream. 2 tablespoons plus 1 teaspoon inverted sugar or light corn syrup. 3 1/2 tablespoons unsalted butter at room temperature and 1/2 cup of cocoa powder. Directions. Step 1. In the top of a double boiler or a heat-proof bowl set over a pot of simmering water, combine the dark and milk chocolates and cook over simmering water, stirring occasionally until they start to melt. Step 2. Remove the chocolate from the heat before fully melted. Continue to stir until melted and smooth. Step 3. In a small saucepan, combine the heavy cream and inverted sugar and place over medium heat until the mixture comes to a boil. Step 4. Remove the saucepan from the heat and pour the cream mixture over the chocolate. Step 5. Stir to combine. Add the butter and stir until completely melted and smooth. Step 6. Let the mixture cool at room temperature until set, but not hard, about 30 minutes. Step 7. Transfer the mixture to a pastry bag fitted with a 1/2 inch smooth tip. Step 8. Pipe spheres of chocolate about 3/4 inch in diameter onto a parchment-lined baking sheet. Step 9. Refrigerate for 1 hour. Step 10. Put the cocoa powder on a plate. Step 11. Gently toss the truffles in the cocoa powder to coat. Step 12. Serve immediately. Refrigerate for up to 2 weeks or freeze in an airtight container for up to 3 months. Defrost frozen truffles in the refrigerator for 24 hours and always bring truffles to room temperature before serving. Special note, inverted sugar is a mixture of glucose and sucrose. It is sweeter than white sugar and helps produce a smooth texture in desserts. It can be purchased online and at any pastry supply stores. The next recipe is chocolate-covered toffee bites. The English word caramel comes from the French, who borrowed it from the Spanish, or possibly from the Portuguese. No matter the etymology, the caramel sauce on these crunchy melt-in-your-mouth treats adds another dimension. Chocolate-covered toffee bites, the ultimate caramel treat from master chocolatier Maribel Lieberman. And it yields about 1 pound. The ingredients are 1 2/3 cup sugar, 2 sticks plus 5 tablespoons unsalted butter, 2 tablespoons of light corn syrup, 2 tablespoons plus 1 teaspoon fine sea salt, 2 tablespoons vanilla paste, 2 tablespoons plus 1 teaspoon baking soda, 1 pound of 64% dark chocolate coarsely chopped, and 1 quarter cup of caramel sauce. Directions. Step 1. Line a 13 by 18 inch baking sheet with parchment paper and set a cooling rack over a second baking sheet. Step 2. In a medium saucepan, combine the sugar, butter, corn syrup, salt, vanilla paste, and 1 quarter cup water and place over medium heat. Step 3. Stir until the butter is incorporated and the mixture is thin but cloudy. Step 4. Bring the mixture to a boil, then let it cook, swirling the pan occasionally until it is amber in color and a candy thermometer registers 290 degrees Fahrenheit or 143 degrees Celsius, 10 to 15 minutes. Step 5. Remove the pan from the heat and immediately whisk in the baking soda until just incorporated. The mixture will start to foam. Use a silicone spatula to pour the mixture onto the parchment-lined baking sheet, but do not spread the mixture with the spatula or compress it. Step 6. Set aside to cool completely at least 30 minutes. Step 7. Lift out the parchment paper and toffee. Wrap it against the counter and use your fingers to break the candy into whatever size pieces you prefer. Step 8. In the top of a double boiler or a heat-proof bowl set over a pot of simmering water, warm 12 ounces of the chocolate until it is melted and a candy thermometer registers 113 degrees Fahrenheit or 45 degrees Celsius. Step 9. Remove from the heat. Step 10. Adding the remaining 4 ounces chocolate and stir constantly until it is melted and the thermometer registers 90 degrees Fahrenheit or 32 degrees Celsius. Step 11. Dip the toffee pieces in the chocolate, letting the excess drip off. Step 12. Place the dipped pieces on the wire rack set over a baking sheet and allow to set in a cool place or the refrigerator for about 15 minutes. Step 13. The toffee will keep in an airtight container for up to 2 weeks. Step 14. To serve, stack pieces of toffee and drizzle with caramel sauce. And the last one of these chocolate recipes is a flourless orange almond cake with chocolate topping. This scrumptious orange almond cake topped with chocolate beautifully combines 3 of my favorite flavors. Fluffy and moist, it makes an elegant dessert. A perfect fall dessert from Maribel Lieberman, flourless orange almond cake with chocolate topping. It serves 8. The ingredients. Unsalted butter for the pan. 1.5 cups almond flour. 1 teaspoon baking powder. Pinch of kosher salt. 4 large eggs at room temperature separated. 1/2 cup of sugar. Grated zest of 1 large orange. 8 ounces of 64% dark chocolate chopped. And cocoa powder for dusting. Directions. Step 1. Preheat the oven to 350 degrees Fahrenheit or 175 degrees Celsius. Butter an 8 or 9 inch, 20 or 23 centimeter, round springform pan and line the bottom with a parchment paper disc. Step 2. In a medium bowl, combine the almond flour, baking powder, and salt. Step 3. With a stand or handheld mixer, beat the egg whites on medium speed until light and foamy about 1 minute. Step 4. With the machine running, gradually add 1/4 cup of the sugar. Increase the speed to medium-high and beat until the egg whites form soft peaks, 1 to 2 additional minutes. Step 5. Combine the egg yolks, orange zest, and remaining 1/4 cup of sugar and beat with a wooden spoon until smooth. Stir in the almond flour mixture and beat until smooth. The mixture will be quite thick. Step 6, add about 1/3 of the egg white mixture and stir it in. Step 7, gently fold in the remaining egg whites with a rubber spatula, taking care not to deflate the batter too much. Step 8, scrape the batter into the prepared pan and bake until it is puffed and a tester inserted in the center comes out with just a few crumbs, about 30 minutes. Step 9, remove to a rack to cool completely. Step 10, to unmold, run a knife around the edge of the pan to loosen the cake, then unbuckle and remove the ring. Step 11, to make the chocolate topping, melt the chopped chocolate into a double boiler or a heat-proof bowl set over a pot of simmering water over low heat. Step 12, spread in a thick layer or a baking sheet and refrigerate until it begins to set but is not yet solid, about 30 minutes. Step 13, once it is almost set, cut out irregular-sized strips of chocolate. Arrange the strips to cover the surface of the cake, overlapping in parts for a rustic effect. Dust with cocoa powder and serve. So there is a book that accompanies these recipes. It's Maribel, and that's spelled M-A-R-I-E, capital B-E-L-L-E, Entertains. Savory and sweet recipes for every occasion from the master chocolatier. And it's $50 at Rizzolusa.com. That's spelled RIZZOLIUSA.com. This next article comes from our books section. The Real Love Story Hidden in Tell Me Everything. In Oprah's 107th Book Club pick, a character references a life-changing essay about a woman's college romance. Turns out, the article is real, and the woman is Elizabeth Strout herself. Read the whole story here. This article is by Elizabeth Strout. At the end of Oprah's 107th book club pick, Tell Me Everything, by Elizabeth Strout, a character references an article called Love is Love that helped her understand that love comes in so many different forms, but it is always love. If it is love, then it is love. We wanted to know everything about this wise and mysterious article. Was it a real story? Where had Elizabeth Strout read it? It turns out that not only is the article real, but Elizabeth Strout published it herself in German. Love is Love, Love or Liebe ist Liebe, or it was originally titled, ran in the German newspaper NZZ back in 2018. You can read the whole essay in English below, tissues not included. Many years ago, when I was very young, I read Till We Have Faces, C.S. Lewis's novel about the four basic types of love, and then his The Four Loves, a philosophical exploration of these loves. In Lewis, there is storge, which is a bond of familial affection, philia, the bond of friendship, eros, the erotic bond, and finally, agape, an unconditional, quasi-divine love. I read these books because I was going through my C.S. Lewis phase, and also because at the time, at 19, I had just fallen in love with my first boyfriend. His name was Peter, and I loved him very much. I believed Lewis's typification. It seemed plausible to divide love into four different forms. But then something happened that I had never forgotten, and I understood something about love that I had not found in Lewis's work. I realized love is love. To explain, I must go back a little and tell you about my great Aunt Dot and great Uncle Roy. They were old enough to be my grandparents. I had only one grandmother by the time I was 5, and no grandfather since I was 2, and I wished fervently that they were. They had grandchildren of their own, of whom I was terribly jealous. Those grandchildren came to Maine once every summer to visit, and I stayed away during those visits. But no sooner had they left than I was back at Aunt Dot and Uncle Roy's door. The cottage where they summered was on the same dirt road as our house, and I visited them every single day of my childhood summers, except for the first few days when their real grandchildren were there. One day, when I must have been about 7, Uncle Roy said as I walked in the door, "I was just talking to Lizzie about you." Lizzie was his nickname for Aunt Dot. "I told her you are the answer to an old man's prayer." Emotional exuberance was not highly regarded in Maine, especially Maine in those days. This must have been the most explicit expression of love I received as a child, except from my father, from whom, with enough persistence, I could occasionally elicit a, "Yes, I love you very much." One time, my parents wanted to stop me from visiting Aunt Dot and Uncle Roy as often as I wanted, because they were afraid I would be a nuisance to them with my constant presence and chatter. So I trudged over to them with a heavy heart and told them I was not allowed to visit them anymore. And they said, "We'll sort it out with your parents." The next day my parents told me it was okay. I could go to see Aunt Dot and Uncle Roy as often as I wanted. Family lore has it that Aunt Dot, one of 4 sisters, weighed only 3 pounds when she was born and was put in the oven to keep her warm. She was, and photographs confirm this, a delicate, exquisitely beautiful woman with a sensitive, overly nervous disposition. And because of this disposition, unlike her sisters, she never went to school. When she was 17, my Uncle Roy, who was then working as a delivery boy, delivered a package to her parents' house in Portland, Maine. And when he came home, he told me himself, he announced to his parents that he had met the woman he was going to marry. Because of her fragility, Aunt Dot was always very dependent on her husband. Uncle Roy was a quiet man, a decent man, and he looked after her well. He needed his afternoon nap, and while he slept, Aunt Dot and I would walk to the mailbox at the front of the street to check the mail. She always wore her little lace-up boots with the little heels. Even in old age, she was beautiful, but I don't think she realized it. When I was in 6th grade, my family went to Germany for the summer, where my father was doing research at the University of Bonn. And when we returned, there was a for sale sign on the lawn of Aunt Dot and Uncle Roy's vacation home. I was devastated. They moved to Florida for the year. I still saw them. We visited them a few times in Florida, but my life was never the same after they left Maine. And then, not long after, Uncle Roy died. While he was sick in the hospital, he worried that the sight of him would be too distressing for his wife, and he wouldn't allow her to visit him. He thought he would live, but he didn't. And I heard relatives talk about Aunt Dot sitting on a chair outside in the hall, frightened and crying. Despite all her fragility, she lived to be 96 years old. When she was 90, her daughter-in-law brought her back to Maine. I hadn't seen her for years before that. I had met and fallen in love with Peter by then, and I was going to college. But here's what stuck with me. She spent the first night with us in my parents' bedroom. They must have moved into my brother's room, who was gone that year. To this day, I can see myself standing in my parents' bedroom at home, and there was this tiny, still beautiful old woman in front of me. It was late, and it was just the two of us in the room. I remember her breath smelling. She was rickety and a little disheveled from the journey. But she was Aunt Dot, my Aunt Dot, and my heart overflowed with love. And then I thought, that's exactly how I feel about Peter. With Peter, of course, there was also the element of Eros, but feeling of pure love for this woman was exactly the same as that for Peter, and I haven't forgotten that. Never. Love is love. That's what I understood that night. In the dim light of the bedroom, she said quietly to me, "I have something for you. It was supposed to go to my granddaughters, but I want you to have it." She dug into her purse and pulled out a tiny ring that Uncle Roy had given her before he gave her the real engagement ring. I still have the ring. I wear it every day. The book that accompanies this article is Tell Me Everything by Elizabeth Strout. It's $28 at Bookshop and $28 at bookshop.org. Still in books, Sidney Poitier's most moving words. A new book with a foreword by Oprah collects the speeches from throughout the icon's career. Here are the quotes we can't stop thinking about. This article is by Charlie Burlock. To most of the world, Sidney Poitier was a boundary-smashing actor, activist, and director. To Oprah, he was a friend. In her foreword to Sidney Poitier's The Greater Great Speeches of an Icon Who Moved Us Forward, Oprah recalls how she and the late film star would routinely spend hours on the phone. I often wish that I had recorded, with his permission, many of our Sunday calls, she writes. I would have taken all those delightful and often funny exchanges and compiled a book of lessons called Sundays with Sidney. While the words he shared in those phone conversations are lost to history, many of his others are not. Poitier personally wrote and saved all of his speeches. Thanks to this new collection, Oprah writes, we now have forever a glimpse into his wisdom, his wit, his grace, his words. While every one of his words is worth a read, and several rereads, we've gathered some of the most moving from the collection for whenever you need a boost of inspiration, gratitude, or grit. As a young man, when I first got to know the world and where I was situated in it, I developed a strong belief that the time would change. Now it is clear that I am changed by time. Knowing your own history puts you within striking distance of knowing yourself. If your reach does not exceed your grasp, then what's a heaven for? Life knows who we are. She also knows where we are, but she rarely comes looking for those of us who are, at the heart of ourselves, spectators. Her engines are not fired by us. We are all made of the same stuff, weaknesses and strengths, hopes and dreams, and a need to leave evidence of our existence etched on the walls of our time. The hands of many human beings are pressed into the molding of a life, and this life standing before you tonight would not be here were it not for the nurturing it received from many the world has made little note of. As human beings, we are often inextricably intertwined in more ways than we can possibly imagine, which makes almost anything possible, which in turn leaves the human family with more challenges than we can possibly keep track of. History is shared by all the people who make it. Clearly, God has made our spirits infinitely tougher than he made the bodies in which he housed them for the short period he needed us in this material world. Inspiration is an energizer. I know, having had to travel such a long distance to get here, inspiration kept my tank full over long, lonely years. It was a good thing, that gift called curiosity. Even though we complain and grumble, we begrudgingly accept that we and nature are necessary players on a larger stage. At my side, in spirit and memory, are those who have accompanied me across the years. How do I say thank you to each of them to sufficiently cover my debt? Behind each deed of kindness was a face, a smile, another human being who cared enough to pause in their own journey to leave me a bit of the best of themselves. The hand of opportunity is usually won by suitors who diligently go in search of her affections. In troubled times, when spoken words lose their power, nature does not grow silent. The language of the heart still speaks, and the language of the soul responds. The performing arts enable us to portray life as it might be and to appreciate it as it is. I must, from this night on, make the most of the years I yet may spend, for therein lies the only way a proper thank you can be said to everyone, but especially to all those warriors who were with me in the trenches, covering my ignorance, my innocence, and my back. I fully expected to be wise by now. I missed. I have come to this place in my life armed only with the knowledge of how little I know. We're in the word of the week. Skin quality. Eye crinkles and inner glow are the truest signs of beauty. This article is by Cassie Hurwitz. Skin quality. Since time immemorial, the beauty industry has been hell-bent on erasing our fine lines, smoothing our wrinkles, and tightening, well, everything. But a new medical term has emerged that shifts the focus to maintaining the health of your skin, not masking every sign of age. Rather than turning back the clock, skin quality is about looking great at your age. It means avoiding quick fixes like filler on a brand new wrinkle, and instead building a consistent long-term routine that keeps skin as healthy, i.e. naturally radiant and supple, as possible. It's also about embracing your individuality. Your sunspots and unpouty lips make you who you are and distinguish you from the parade of sculpted fembody faces ducking out of plastic surgeons' offices. This is in a section titled Women Who Start Things, and the article is The Digital Game Changer for Empowering Entrepreneurs. Co-founder Elizabeth Gore shares how Hello Alice has revolutionized small business success. This article is by Sophia Lodato. Elizabeth Gore is the co-founder of Hello Alice, a fintech platform that uses data to overcome systemic barriers and access to credit, loans, grants, and more. Founded in 2017, Hello Alice is a small business for small businesses. Their primary focus is helping the new majority, women, BIPOC, and veterans, grow their businesses. They have supported 1.5 million small businesses this year and have deployed 5,163 philanthropic small business grants, totaling $47.3 million. The inspiration. I was the first woman in my family to get to go to college. I was always inspired by the women around me who could start their own small businesses. I was in the Peace Corps for a while, and then I was with the UN for a decade. When I got home and started focusing my energy and time on the United States, I was floored by how hard it is here for women, people of color, and U.S. veterans to start and grow a business. If you look at the data, women are getting less than 2% of funding in venture capital, even though, when funded, we tend to surpass our male counterparts on profitability. It's the same thing with bank loans, traditional bank loans, and access to credit. There's a $40 billion gap in the BIPOC community alone for business credit. If you look at U.S. veterans who have been deployed, when they come home and don't have credit history, they tend to be fully declined as well. The way that our economic system is built isn't conducive for people who don't have a credit history or who have bad credit. The goal. My co-founder and I, Carolyn Rotz, primary focus on day one was what we called the new majority. Women, people of color, and U.S. veterans. Those were our three primary targets to help them launch and grow a business by getting equitable access to capital. We then heard a lot from these three demographics that they wanted to be a part of the entire ecosystem. So we open the platform up to anyone. We fund white males. We fund people in all 50 states. However, our commitment has been steadfast since we launched that we will be prioritizing the new majority. We have rolled out paths for the LGBTQ+ community. We have an awesome growing community of people with disabilities. They're creating innovative businesses. What we do is use data to overcome systemic barriers on access to credit, loans, grants, you name it. The hardest part. It was interesting to live in what we're trying to help with. Carolyn and I, as a tech company, needed venture funding pretty early, and we got hundreds of no's. As two female founders, and Carolyn being a person of color, we just got the door slammed in our faces over and over and over. It took years, and we did what we told our owners not to do. We maxed out credit cards. We put mortgages on our homes. Carolyn, actually, and her two kids moved in with me and my two kids. We shared child care and built this with no salaries on our own for a while because we could not get funding. You also have, as a woman, these very unique circumstances and challenges in addition to running your company. We're both fanatical about our children, and as parents, we don't want to miss anything. As CEOs and founders, we juggle that as well. It's constant, but it's all a great challenge to be in. The results. We're a small but mighty team, and we're growing like crazy. We've hit profitability. I want to prove to everyone in the United States that our audience is profitable. Women and people of color and U.S. veterans make good money. We've also, accidentally, built a visceral community that loves each other. On our platform, you can connect and create communities for business owners. For example, we now have the largest community for Black-owned businesses with NAACP. That part is, I'd say, the beating heart of what we do is small business owners helping each other. And it was a huge part of what we did during COVID. We've definitely been a target over the years on different things, but it just makes us stronger, and our communities always rally around each other. It's been a wild ride that we're still on. Your favorite partnership. We have the tightest and most innovative partnership with the NAACP that you can imagine. We actually had already been partnering with Derek Johnson and Yumeka Rushing, the two heads of the NAACP, and we run all of their grants and loan programs. We built the Black-owned Business Center with them, which had hundreds of thousands of NAACP members who had small businesses engaging with each other overnight. We felt like we had so many of their members that we ended up giving equity and shares to the NAACP. As a venture-backed company, we felt like they should have voting rights and governance on where the platform is heading, because they are now our largest audience. Advice for upcoming entrepreneurs. Start your business, particularly for women. We are so thoughtful and we're such planners, and there's never technically a good time to take that risk or that jump. You should just do it. It's so simple, but most of us just need that little extra push or confidence to get started. Buy your domain, register your LLC, take that first step, and then we can help you from there. I want to give your readers the confidence that this is the time. Go do it. Follow your dream. Be your own boss. This is the time. This next article is from Lifestyle. My journey with HS from adolescence to adulthood. Hidradenitis suppurativa is a chronic, systemic, and often painful skin condition. Here's what it's like living with it. This article is by Aza That's A-S-A Canty, C-A-N-T-Y. Although Nayandashe now makes an active effort to speak openly about her life with hidradenitis suppurativa, HS, she still remembers how isolating it was to develop the condition as a teenager on the verge of starting high school. "I was very closed off," she recalls. "I didn't want to speak about it. It was almost like I was in a bubble." HS is a chronic and often painful skin disease that can cause recurring boil-like abscesses, which can burst into open wounds and may cause irreversible scarring. For Nayandashe, it was an arduous journey to receive an accurate diagnosis and find a treatment plan that worked for her. "My condition was a frustrating mystery. At the age of 14, Nayandashe noticed what seemed to be a cluster of small blackheads underneath her underarms. While seemingly innocuous at first, the blackheads gradually worsened, turning into painful cysts and boils that frequently filled with pus and blood, requiring professional draining. Each time she sought medical help, she was told that her problems may be hygiene-related. I saw multiple primary care providers, hoping that somebody could tell me what the problem was," Nayandashe recalls. "Over and over again, she received the same advice. 'This will go away if you keep up with your personal hygiene.' But Nayandashe was prioritizing her hygiene, and yet her symptoms still persisted and even worsened. Her teenage life, characterized by a burgeoning interest in engineering, family time, and hanging out with friends, was altered. 'I had low energy. I wasn't functioning like normal,' she remembers. 'The pain restricted my movement at times and made sleep difficult.' She relied on a host of holistic measures throughout high school to manage her symptoms, including hot and cold compresses, turmeric masks, and constant wound care. But without an accurate diagnosis, she was always playing catch-up to manage her symptoms after they presented instead of treating the cause. After multiple visits with primary care doctors, Nayandashe was eventually referred to a dermatologist who identified her symptoms as evidence of a systemic disease, meaning a condition that impacts multiple body systems. At the end of the appointment, Nayandashe, who was 18 years old at the time, finally received an accurate diagnosis: hidradenitis suppurativa. Receiving a diagnosis was a relief. HS is a chronic condition that can develop anywhere on the body, but is most common in areas where skin meets skin, like the groin, inner thighs, buttocks, under the breasts, and in the armpits. The variability in its presentation, combined with a widespread lack of awareness about the condition, makes it all too common for patients to go long stretches of time without an accurate diagnosis, particularly among patients of color. Common misdiagnoses include acne, razor burn, folliculitis, and STDs, says Jennifer Hasio, MD, a dermatologist based in Los Angeles. This can take a toll on patients' lives, both physically and emotionally. As HS is a progressive condition, which Dr. Hasio explains means it tends to worsen over time if it's not adequately treated, it's important to receive an accurate diagnosis as soon as possible. But for many, this can take as long as a decade. So when Nayandashe was able to put a name to her condition, it was a breakthrough moment that set her on the path to managing her condition. "It was a relief," she says. "Let's build on this," I thought. Finding a treatment is a personal journey. Diagnosis was only the first step of Nayandashe's journey toward condition management. In the years that followed, she pursued a series of different treatment methods, par for the course for HS patients. Most HS treatment plans are multi-module or a combination of different therapies, says Dr. Hasio. Treatments can include lifestyle modification, hormonal and metabolic medications, antibiotics, biologics, a medication that is made from living sources and taken by injection, and surgical procedures. At first, nothing Nayanda Shea tried was providing the consistency that she wished for. When her dermatologist suggested that she consider biologic treatments, she did her own independent research and agreed that a biologic treatment was worth considering. For patients with moderate to severe HS, biologics are a cornerstone of my management approach, says Dr. Hazayo. Nayanda Shea worked with her dermatologist to develop a treatment plan that worked for her, which included Cosentyx secukinumab, a biologic treatment option approved by the FDA for adults with moderate to severe HS. Cosentyx treats HS from within by inhibiting interleukin-17A, a protein believed to play a role in the inflammation leading to HS symptoms. Now on treatment, Nayanda Shea has been able to better manage her HS symptoms. Here's what I hope others learn from my story. With her HS now managed, Nayanda Shea has made it a priority to spread awareness of the condition to both other HS patients and the broader medical community. I'm more vocal about my HS now, she says. It's amazing to talk about it and help other people with HS realize that it's not just me with this condition, even though it can feel that way. Looking forward, she wants HS patients to have the resources and support they need to have effective conversations with their doctor and hopefully find a treatment plan that works for them. Over in Culture and News, Zendaya is looking forward to getting married and starting a family someday. This article is by Chelsea Sanchez. Marriage and kids are apparently on Zendaya's mind, even if both of those things aren't necessarily happening anytime soon. In a new interview with Entertainment Weekly, Zendaya opened up about stepping outside of acting roles that portrayed her as a child and embracing major life milestones that she has yet to experience. I have been playing quite young. I say I've been playing a 16-year-old since I was 16. Sitting here, right now, I probably look a little bit like a child because I'm not in hair and makeup, she said. Alluding to her character on Euphoria, she added, I get the rue of it all, and that totally works and has worked for me, but also I am not a child. In some ways, taking on the role of Tashi, a tennis coach, wife, and mother in Challengers, has opened a new realm of acting possibilities for her. She explained, At some point, you have to play characters that are your own age and have experiences that you don't have. For example, having children or getting married, while those are all things I want and I'm looking forward to, they just haven't happened quite yet. While Zendaya hinted about her desire to get married and start a family, she tends to shy away from speaking personally on her relationship with boyfriend Tom Holland. Their romance first became public knowledge when paparazzi captured photos of the two kissing in July 2021. Although fans speculated that their love story may have started long before that on the set of Spider-Man Homecoming. One of the downsides of our fame is that privacy isn't really in our control anymore. And a moment that you think is between two people that love each other very much is now a moment that is shared with the entire world. Holland said in a 2021 interview with GQ, I've always been really adamant to keep my private life private, because I share so much of my life with the world anyway. We sort of felt robbed of our privacy. Again in Culture and News, Kate Middleton meets with 16-year-old teen battling cancer at Windsor Castle. The Princess of Wales recently announced she completed chemotherapy and is making a slow return to royal duties. This article is by Emily Burek. Kate Middleton made a surprise appearance at Windsor Castle today for a special reason. She was there to meet a young teenager battling cancer. Liz Hatton, 16, is a budding photographer from Harrogate. She was diagnosed with desmoplastic small round cell tumor in January and is currently battling the rare and aggressive form of cancer. Her mom told the BBC that doctors have told Liz she has between 6 months and 3 years to live. The Prince and Princess of Wales welcomed Liz and her family to Windsor Castle today after Prince William invited Liz to take photos of the investiture held there. A pleasure to meet with Liz at Windsor today, a talented young photographer whose creativity and strength has inspired us both. Thank you for sharing your photos and story with us, they posted on social media after, in a personal note signed WNC for William and Catherine. Liz reposted the photos on her Instagram and wrote, "Such lovely, genuine, and kind people. I'm over the moon that my family and I had this experience. The last 9 months have been incredibly tough for us as a family. Life, as you know, it can change in an instant, and we have had to find a way to navigate the stormy waters and road unknown," the Princess of Wales said. "The cancer journey is complex, scary, and unpredictable for everyone, especially those closest to you." She added, "Doing what I can to stay cancer-free is now my focus. Although I have finished chemotherapy, my path to healing and full recovery is long, and I must continue to take each day as it comes. I am, however, looking forward to being back at work and undertaking a few more public engagements in the coming months when I can." Kensington Palace hasn't put a date on Kate's return to royal duties, but have confirmed 2 engagements for her for the rest of 2024, Remembrance Sunday in November and her Christmas Carol service in December. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.